Thanks, Tim, alcoholic.
I did.
Okay, guys, step one tonight. We're on page 30. More about alcoholism. We are going to take step one tonight. Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. What's a real alcoholic? Someone beyond human aid. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. So, of course, this is Silkworth's idea of that it's a twofold disease, mental obsession and physical phenomena of craving kicks in when we put alcohol in our body, mental and physical. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. For those of you looking for where step one is in the book, it's this next sentence. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. Of course, you can read the official step on page 59, but this is the question that one could potentially ask a sponsee. It's not mandatory. You can word it in other ways, but we're going to ask this question in a few moments when we read a little bit more to really understand what we're buying into. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. This sentence confused me for the longest time. I could get on with the delusion that we were like other people, makes perfect sense to me, comma, or presently maybe. Don't understand what the heck it said. I'm sitting at home, I'm thinking about it, I'm meditating on it, and it comes to me. This is my interpretation. It's actually talking about two different phases of alcoholic. The delusion that we were like other people, that's after we've stopped drinking, mental obsession will be that we're actually like regular people and we can go back to drinking. Or presently maybe means we're still drinking and we're trying to convince ourselves and others that we are actually normal people. Play with that one for a little while. You don't have to have that one right away. And I'm also basing that interpretation on the subsequent paragraphs that we're going to read. So stick with that first. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. So that's talking about the first part of that sentence. All of us felt, at times, that we were regaining control, but at such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, powerlessness, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's hopelessness. Hopelessness is a key ingredient to getting sober. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. Once a pickle, never a cucumber again. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. This was written in 1939. Has anything changed?
Nope.
In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse, progression. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism, not your dermatologist. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Once you're beyond human aid, you never go backwards. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception, dishonesty, and experimentation, and we're going to see a bunch of examples in the next paragraph of experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people, which means we've tried to manage our drinking. We've tried to manage our lives. In step one, what's our life? Unmanageable. Why is it unmanageable? Use of self-will on something that's beyond human aid. Here are some of the methods. This is the experimentation. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only. Limiting the number of drinks. Never drinking alone. Never drinking in the morning. Drinking only at home. Never having it in the house. Never drinking during business hours. Drinking only at parties. Switching from scotch to brandy. Drinking only natural wines. Agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job. Taking a trip. Not taking a trip. Swearing off forever with and without a solemn oath. Taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase the list ad infinitum. So that is saying whatever you try via self-will will not work. And after you stop drinking, if you try to control all of your life with self-will, you will have an unmanageable life. We do not like to pronounce any individual as alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest barroom and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It will not take long for you to decide. If you are honest with yourself about it, it may be worth a bad case of jitters if you get a full knowledge of your condition. Though there is no way of proving it, we believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there is yet time. So we don't see ourselves as hopeless. We see ourselves as powerful. We see ourselves as being able to control via self-will our drinking. And when we realize that we can't, it's too late. And the tricky thing about it is that self-will works in so many other areas, right? We're going to have Jan 1 comes up. It's New Year's Day and people are going to take a resolution. I'm going to the gym 4 times a week. Some of us self-will, that will work. Some of us, that will work. So it may give some person the impression that that will work in all aspects of life. It doesn't. We have heard of a few instances where people who showed definite signs of alcoholism were able to stop for a long period because of an overpowering desire to do so. Here is one. So this is a nice little story. This is not an AA story. Bill borrowed this from A Common Sense of Drinking. Bill read the book, Common Sense of Drinking, and it was written by Richard Peabody, Dick Peabody. And this story, I think, it's not by mistake this is in here. This does a masterful job of showing that even though you stop drinking, if you come back to it and you're a real alcoholic, you will pick up just like you never stopped. A man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. He was powerless over the amount he took, right? Phenomenon of craving kicked in. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man. He remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to a belief which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, meaning manage, right? He tried to control his drinking, making several trips to the hospital meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. Age 59, he dies. This case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remained sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. But here is a man who at 55 years found he was just where he had left off at 30. We have seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in a short time as bad as ever. So I've gotten into the habit of now using this next line before I take somebody through the first step. And I make sure that they're crystal clear that the minute they agree with this step, that they're powerless over alcohol and that their life is unmanageable due to self-will. If you buy into that, then you have to buy into this sentence. Here it is. If you are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind. In other words, 100%. Nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. Once you say you're an alcoholic, can't take it back. No backsies. Right? Okay, so normally I get up to that point then, and we're going to take step one. You guys relax. The answer to the question is going to be yes or silence. If it's silence, talk to your sponsor. So we're back to page 30, first line of second paragraph. I'll just read it one more time. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. So I turn that into a question. I'm talking to the sponsee. Do you fully concede to your innermost self that you are an alcoholic?
Yes.
You just took step one. Don't need a Hazleton workbook. That's it. Sort of neat and clean. But again, and this is a conversation that we just had the other night, I am emphatic about making sure that we understand that last sentence I read before I do that. Because quite often people will buy in, they're all in, but yet they're thinking that at some point, well, you know, if I put enough time between me and the booze, I can go back to it. No. And they agreed to it already. Okay, back to 33. Young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think that they can stop, as he did, on their own willpower. So yeah, this guy, a man of 30, did stop on his willpower. It didn't work. I don't care that he didn't drink for 25 years. He died of it. So length of time is irrelevant. You know, somebody says, yeah, I haven't drank for a year, and they've been a miserable, you know, human existence. It doesn't count to me. That's no good. We doubt if many of them can do it, because none will really want to stop. They won't see themselves as hopeless. If you don't see yourself as powerless, you won't do these things. And hardly one of them, because of the peculiar mental twist already acquired, will find he can win out. Several of our crowd, men of 30 or less, had been drinking only a few years, but they found themselves as helpless as those who had been drinking 20 years. Who was our first man of 30 or less? Who was our man 30 or less? Ernie Galbraith, AA number 4, 7-month slip. That was his story. Taken out of the big book. Why? Drank. So he's in experience, strength, and hope. But so he married Dr. Bob's daughter under Dr. Bob's protest, and apparently was not such a great guy. But AA number 4, Ernie Galbraith from Akron. To be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time, nor take the quantity some of us have. This is particularly true of women. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. Certain drinkers, who would be greatly insulted if called alcoholics, are astonished at their inability to stop. We, who are familiar with the symptoms, see large numbers of potential alcoholics among young people everywhere. But try and get them to see it. Note, bottom of the page. Depending on your printing, Sarah's probably got a different printing there. True, when this book was first published, but 2007 U.S.-Canada membership survey showed about 1/13 of AAs were 30 or under. 1/13 is 7.7%. I had a number from 2011 of 13%. So you may have different numbers based on your printing, not your edition, your printing. But I think our current number is approximately 13%, 30 and less. Back to the top of the page. As we look back, we feel we had gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our willpower. If anyone questions whether he has entered this dangerous area, let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year. If he is a real alcoholic and very far advanced, there is scant chance of success. In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remain sober for a year or more, becoming serious drinkers again later. Though you may be able to stop for a considerable period, you may yet be a potential alcoholic. We think few, to whom this book will appeal, can stay dry anything like a year. Some will be drunk the day after making their resolutions, most of them within a few weeks. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether, meaning to stay stopped. Lots of people stop. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit and stay quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. Beyond choice, or beyond choice. How then shall we help our readers determine to our own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. For obviously, this is the crux of the problem. Why is it the crux of the problem? If you don't put booze in your body, the physical aspect of the disease can't kick in. The phenomenon of craving can't start. So it's always an issue with the mind. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? powerlessness. Of what is he thinking? Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found. He made a beginning. What do we think that means? Yeah, great. Step three. Probably got up to step three. Did 90 and 90. You know, maybe asked if, you know, will you be my sponsor? He hadn't done anything yet, though, right? He didn't really get into the meat and the potatoes. Had not really found the solution. So he made a beginning. His family was reassembled and began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time. Uh-oh. But he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in a serious condition. That's him. He took step one. I'm a real alcoholic and I'm in a serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had a deep affection. Yet, he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. And Joe and Charlie have a little fun with this one, right? I came to work on Tuesday morning. I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. That's a resentment for those who missed that, right? Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I'd get a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I had been going to it for years. I had eaten there many times during the months I was sober. I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. So he didn't have the solution, so he has no defense against the first drink. He's not even on board yet, right? Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him, meaning the DTs, right? He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. And we learned already what self-knowledge gets you, right? Bupkis, right? Yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. So how do we define insanity? Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. How can such a lack of proportion, of the ability to think straight, be called anything less? You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that, parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we would ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity, how it could have happened. So the insane idea is the mental obsession. In some circumstances, we have gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by, these are all shortcomings, nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. I think we could add in restless, irritable, and discontented, right? But even in this type of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what always happened. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. We're going to stop there tonight.